Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. One of the longest-serving Democrats in the state legislature is accused of creating a hostile work environment. The political arm of Planned Parenthood of Northern New England endorses Molly Kelly in the Democratic race for governor, a race that's seen some heated rhetoric this week. And remember CD2? New Hampshire's first congressional district has taken up a lot of oxygen so far this summer, but we've got candidates running in the second. We'll meet one of them in this hour, Republican Lynn Blankenbecker. Listeners, you can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. Here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and political reporter Paul Steinhauser, and NHPR's Casey McDermott. Thank you, everybody, for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you,
hey, Peter.
Again, listeners, the phone number for you to call to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. All right, Casey, you've been reporting on Dan Eaton, a Democrat who has served 14 terms in the House. In your latest report, he was accused of creating a hostile work environment. What exactly was he accused of doing?
Sure. So I should start by saying that we got a series of records last week from the House of Representatives in response to a request that we made for documents and other complaints related to their anti-harassment policy. We've been kind of following this issue, particularly in the last year or so, in light of the Me Too movement and heightened awareness around kind of workplace harassment or other workplace conditions as it relates to the State House. So we got this batch of records. Included in those records was one complaint that and associated memos about a lawmaker who was alleged to have created a hostile work environment through a series of comments that he was making toward a staffer at the State House. And the staffer was the one who brought forward this complaint to House leadership. They looked into it. The lawmaker, according to the memos, when confronted about what he had said, did not deny it, said that it was meant in kind of a banter, like a brother and sister banter. Clearly, the staffer did not feel the same way. This person described it as, creating kind of an abusive environment. It made it very difficult for her to work. She wrote in a written complaint that this is just one incident in a long pattern of behavior that made her feel uncomfortable. Among other things, the lawmaker was alleged to have referred to the staffer as an old bat, a granny in the corner. He made comments about her hating men. So it created an environment that she felt was intimidating and abusive, and those are her words. So that was all outlined in the documents. What was not outlined was the name of Eaton or any other lawmaker that was credibly accused of harassment. But I was able to independently verify through multiple sources that Eaton was the subject of that complaint.
You did a lot of interviews to sort of figure out the facts of this that fit with the documents that you had from the state. Okay. So how did the state respond internally when these complaints were first made?
Sure. So according to the memos, it looks like the House Chief of Staff, talked to the person who filed the complaint, talked to other people who were witnesses to the comments, and then after that talked to Eaton himself and said, this is what these people said that you said. does that sound accurate? He said that it probably was, according to the memos. As I said, he also described it as a kind of banter that he and the staffer had engaged in. And then also it looks like, according to the memos, that the House Chief of Staff encouraged Eaton to, you know, perhaps seek out additional training from a state-sponsored program that provides, you know, sexual harassment training to the House. It's unclear whether that actually happened.
Paul, did you want to say something?
Yeah, a little bit about Eaton, 62 years old, 14 terms now in the House. And for somebody who covers campaign politics, he's a longtime friend of the former Vice President Joe Biden. And you remember a couple of years ago when Biden was thinking about making that run for the Democratic nomination, Eaton was really one of the guys who was kind of getting the gang together here in New Hampshire in case the Vice President ended up running, which, of course, he did not.
Mm-hmm. And is he sort of in a place where he could reliably, because he's a Democrat, expect to be reelected? Is that...
It's a pretty safe seat, I think that's fair to say. But again, this new reporting from Casey could change things.
Okay, so Casey, what does this say about the way the House is handling these things?
Sure. So I think just kind of additionally, you know, to provide some additional context to what Paul was mentioning, not only has he been, you know, a longstanding, very active member of the Democratic Party and the legislature in Concord, he's also a member of arguably the most powerful committee at the House, which is the House Finance Committee. So that's a committee that makes decisions about spending, about, you know, what kind of causes get, you know, certain amounts of money allocated toward them in the budget and otherwise. So that's a very powerful post. And for that reason, that I think made it a little bit more difficult for the people that I talked to feel comfortable speaking openly about their concerns and about this complaint. On top of that, I do just want to underscore that this complaint involved a legislative staffer, and that legislative staffers have, you know, pretty significant barriers to speaking up about any kind of, you know, bad behavior that may be, you know, going on, especially on the part of legislators. So
tell us what those barriers are.
So they aren't covered by the same Public Employee Relations Act as the rest of, as many other public employees in the state. They're at will. They're basically kind of at the mercy of whatever legislators are in power. They can decide to hire and fire, you know, committee secretaries, other people who are working at the state house. You know, it's up to the legislators. So
in some ways, they might be vulnerable to retaliation if they come up.
And you know, I do just want to emphasize that the State House's anti-harassment policy makes clear that retaliation is not tolerated, and that in and of itself may be grounds for punishment.
But the way the House can punish lawmakers is sort of limited, right? You can't remove someone from office.
Well, that's the position that the House has taken. And actually, on that note, I do think it's also important to point out that the House leadership has, you know, I do want to emphasize that according to, you know, the interviews that I've had with House leadership, that they do, you know, at the very least respond when they are presented with allegations of misconduct. You know, they'll talk to the lawmaker involved. They'll talk to the person who brought forward the complaint and try to come up with some resolution. But after that, they say that their ability to actually, like, discipline lawmakers is limited. They say that that's up to either, you know, other members of the general court, so legislators can decide to bring forward some kind of disciplinary action against one of their peers, or it's up to, they say, the voters who have, you know, they make the decision about whether or not to send these people back to Concord every 2 years. So that, you know, keeping that in mind, I think it's important to emphasize that the House is not disclosing when lawmakers have been accused of misconduct. So it's very difficult for members of the public, members of the media, and even, you know, members of the legislature to know if other legislators have been accused once or maybe even multiple times.
So if discipline is to happen, it most likely will happen in the court of public opinion for voters, which is why reporting like yours, Casey, is just so important. Dean, did you want to say something?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, absent some sort of prosecutable crime, the reality is it's up to voters to sanction the individual in the end. And, you know, workplace harassment and hostile work environments, these are things that, you know, I've been talking about and reading about for as long as I can remember, but the Me Too movement has really brought a new level of scrutiny, not only to how people behave in the workplace, which I think is probably surprising to some people, but also in terms of the absence or presence of transparency and the absence or presence of the ability to get some sort of remediation or to be able, as Casey was saying, to be able to actually address these problems in a meaningful way. So we're seeing these changes being made in fits and starts around the country, not only in private workplaces, but in state legislature. Congress has been to some extent trying to grapple with this as well. It's really kind of a very different environment now. And it's just interesting to me to see attempts in the state legislature to deal with this, and also just for people to start learning about how the process really works and the ability or lack thereof to address these kinds of hostile work environments.
Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. If you have questions or comments about this story or anything else in the week's news, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. Casey, you've also been reporting on comments made by Senator Andy Sanborn to a State House intern. This week, we learned what those comments were. Casey, what can you tell us about this new information?
Sure. So just it might be helpful to step back and kind of remind people what we're talking about here. So we started learning, I believe it was the end of last year, that in 2013, there was some kind of exchange between Senator Andy Sanborn and others at the State House that, you know, led the State House to seek out an outside law firm to look into the situation. That law firm specializes in, among other things, workplace harassment. But the details of that were limited. And over the last few months, we've learned more and more about what actually took place. Initially, the senator said that, you know, he acknowledged using crass language and that sparked the inquiry. But over time, you know, he's kind of referred to the situation. He's kind of dismissed questions about it. He hasn't answered direct questions about what he actually said. And so more recently, I believe back in June, the Attorney General's office revealed that it had convened an investigation to look into allegations that, you know, perhaps someone had paid the intern who was on the receiving end of the senator's comments to stay quiet about the situation, or that there had been other things that had done to attempt to get this person to stay quiet. The AG's office found no indication that there was an attempt to silence this person. But in the course of their investigation, they did a number of interviews with people who were familiar with the situation. One of those people was the Senate lawyer who actually overheard the comment. And after the AG's office publicized their investigation, people had, various organizations and individuals, including NHPR, submitted requests for the records that they had associated with that investigation. And they released a batch of records last week that included transcripts with the Senate attorney who overheard the comment, in which the Senate attorney actually said his recollection of what the senator said. So long story short, until now, we didn't know what the comment actually was, or no one would actually publicly confirm what it was. We now know that the senator made a reference to a sex act to that intern. And according to the transcript, everyone at the time kind of brushed it off as a joke. Efforts were made to kind of talk to the other people who witnessed it and ask, you know, do you feel like this was harassment? Do you feel uncomfortable, intimidated by this? And according to the transcripts, no one said that they were uncomfortable. Everyone said that they agreed that it was kind of, in jest. That being said, I do think it's worth noting that, you know, Sanborn has, over the last few months, dismissed the matter as, quote, total BS, a witch hunt, fake news, the product of his political enemies, when, you know, in fact, there, you know, we now know that he said something that referenced a sex act to, you know, one of his subordinates at the State House. So I think that's, you know, worth disclosing.
Paul, did you want to comment?
Yeah, let's talk about the politics here. We're 4.5 weeks out from the primary, and you've got a bruising battle right now in the first congressional district between Sanborn and Eddie Edwards for the GOP nomination. And as Casey said, I interviewed Sanborn last week with my friend and co-host Chris Ryan. And yeah, he got very upset when we brought this up. He said it was a joke. I responded to it. No one's ever charged me with doing anything wrong, called us fake news. And then turned the tables and said, what about Eddie Edwards? And he said that he was forced to resign from his job at the state of New Hampshire on the Liquor Commission. He was referring, of course, to Edwards' settlement back in 2013 with the Liquor Commission after he charged that he was a subject of discrimination. This incident, though, that Casey's been talking about, two top Edwards supporters just in recent days called on Sanborn to get out of the race, saying that this controversy would hurt him if he won the nomination. It's important, they said, for us to win back the Democratic-held seat. So this is really becoming a huge political football. This story is not going away. Sanborn would like it to go away. The Edwards campaign is, I think it's fair to say, enjoying this story being in the limelight.
Well, I'd love to hear from listeners who have strong feelings about this one way or the other. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. What do you think of Senator Andy Sanborn, both his comments and the news coverage of it? 1-800-892-6477. I'm glad you commented on that, Paul, because, I mean, Sanborn got the endorsement of Senator Ted Cruz this week. That's worth mentioning. So you got to wonder how much voters care about this.
You know, in a low turnout Republican primary, which is probably going to trend conservative, I'm not sure. I think this, you know, the battle between Sanborn and Edwards is moving to be a battle to the right. This is an important story, but again, I'm not sure how much it's going to play in the primary. Both campaigns, though, and this is, you know, we've been talking a lot about the first district on the Democratic side, how it's been getting kind of feisty. On the Republican side, these two campaigns are really starting to take off the gloves.
Yeah, and it's just the nature of a primary. When you have two candidates, or in some cases you may have even more, and they're trying to draw distinctions between each other, but the reality is on positions, they're not all that different. You tend to fall back on these kinds of attacks on, you know, temperament or personality. And, you know, we predicted a long time ago that this was not going to go away. Then at some point it would become an issue probably within the last month of the primary. And that's exactly what has happened. As Paul mentioned, he did that interview with Chris Ryan. And, you know, very clearly Sanborn believes that this should be done with and left in the past, and gets increasingly upset when you bring it back up. He feels like the media is trying to insert itself into the race in some way. But it's going to continue to be an issue. Whether it's the primary focus of voters, as Paul said, we don't know yet. But I'm not surprised to see them get into this kind of finger pointing on the sort of temperament or behavioral grounds.
You know, I do think it's important to also note, you know, as Paul alluded to before, that this is not just a matter of kind of partisanship and Democrats coming after Sanborn, or, you know, the media targeting him in our reports. You know, we are reporting on publicly available information about an elected official. But we're hearing concerns from Republicans, too, who have raised concerns about, look, this is something that potentially, if Sanborn is the nominee, could make him more vulnerable in the general election. So it's not just a matter of, you know, this is causing attacks or prompting attacks from Democrats. This is something that's also, you know, as has been mentioned, that's coming from Republicans as well.
Well, NHPR's Casey McDermott, thank you very much for joining us for this part of the program and talking about your reporting. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can find links to Casey's reporting at our website, nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're speaking with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital, and political reporter Paul Steinhauser. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the race for governor and the rhetoric in that race. Emily's List accuses the Steve Marchand campaign of using sexist and ageist language to discredit opponent Molly Kelly. What do you think of that? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
I'm Laura Canoy. The Exchange has been going local all summer, exploring the unique regions of New Hampshire. And as part of our series, we'll be heading to Keene, the heart of the Monadnock region, to discuss the biggest issues facing that area and what residents love most about their home. The show will be live at Keene State College on August 16th at 9 a.m. So reserve your free tickets now at nhpr.org/events.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital, and political reporter Paul Steinhauser. And with you, give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news, 1-800-892-6477. Let's turn our attention for a little while to the campaign for governor. Emily's List this week accused Steve Marchand of using sexist and ageist language to discredit his opponent, Molly Kelly. Emily's List says Marchand called Kelly, quote, timid on public policy and said he would bring, quote, the energy of youth to the job. So those would be the sexist and ageist accusations, respectively. Paul, your thoughts on this?
Well, this started with the Planned Parenthood endorsement. This is where it all came from. It started with the Planned Parenthood endorsement of Molly Kelly in this race. These are the two Democrats, of course, battling it out. September 11th is the primary. The winner will face off against Republican Governor Chris Sununu. Both candidates have really been talking about, and we've talked about this a couple weeks ago, both the Democrats have been talking nonstop about abortion rights, about the Brett Kavanaugh nomination, about, you know, which one is the bigger supporter of women's reproductive rights. Ever since the Kennedy resignation announcement in late June. This has been a big issue for them. So Planned Parenthood weighing in, that's a big deal, of course, right? Planned Parenthood, it's a major organization, and it also comes with a lot of support. So they decided to go with Molly Kelly, looking mostly at her record, you know, her record in the State House, in the State Senate, a decade of fighting for women's reproductive rights. Marchand took you know, offense. I guess he was obviously upset with that. The timid on policy, that's actually not too far. You know, that's almost legitimate in a way, and here's why. Marchand has been talking specifically. He laid out a 5-point plan back in early July about what he would do to protect women's reproductive rights. And as Josh Rogers, your own Josh Rogers, did a nice job this week, he pointed out that Kelly has not said where she stands on whether there should be public funding of abortion through Medicaid, whereas Marchand has concretely said that he supports that. So on the age, the energy of youth, well, Marchand, all I can say is the ages. Marchand is 44 and Kelly is 68. Now, that was an appropriate comment. Obviously, Emily's List disagreed. Emily's List, of course, a very powerful national organization as well. They've been big supporters of Molly Kelly even before she got into the race. So, again, like we were just talking about in the race for Congress, this governor's race is the gloves are definitely coming off here too between Kelly and Marchand.
Yeah, I mean, part of the issue with the Planned Parenthood endorsement, and you referred to it briefly. You know, Molly Kelly has been a little unclear about where she stands on the Hyde Amendment, which is this federal amendment that prohibits most federal tax dollars being spent on abortions. It's removing it has been on a Democratic platform. Hillary Clinton was opposed to it. She's been a little bit less clear. At least that's been the criticism of her by her opponents. And, you know, just bigger picture on this race, as I've said many times before, given the kind of metrics that Chris Sununu has now in terms of reelection, popularity, et cetera, you know, a lot of whether or not he wins is going to depend on the extent to which this election is a blue wave or not. If it's a big blue wave, he might be in trouble. If not, he's in reasonably good shape. So I think, you know, who the Democratic nominee is in November is probably a little bit less important than the larger political context of the election for Sununu. That said, I think this is a, you know, important debate to have within the Democratic Party. There are kind of different wings in the party, and, you know, Steve Marchand has been accused of kind of rebranding himself as a progressive when he used to be a moderate, and we've heard that criticism. That's nothing new. We've heard that criticism before, but it is interesting to me, and I think I said it maybe with you when you were on the last time, you know, Marchand rolls out these 5-point plans on everything.
One after another.
Yeah, the reality is, in the end, most voters come back to these issues of kind of temperament and leadership and just kind of a gut-level feeling. They probably can't tell you what's in the 5-point plan. So as much as candidates try to shift the focus to policy, in the end, we keep coming back to these sort of very, very personal, whether it's the Republicans, as we were just discussing, or the Democrats, it comes back to kind of temperament and leadership, et cetera. So we're getting close to the primary. I'm not surprised to see things heating up in this way. But in the end, you know, a lot of what happens to Sununu is going to be driven by the larger context of the anti-Trump vote and whether or not Republicans show up in November.
And Paul, comment on the Planned Parenthood endorsement, or the political arm of the Planned Parenthood of Northern New England endorsing Molly Kelly. Like, how big a deal is that? Is that going to be a significant thing for this campaign?
It definitely helps. Listen, I mean, that comes with a lot of, you know, that comes with a lot of support. That comes with they've got a big voter list. That doesn't hurt one bit. It's an endorsement, I think, that, you know, obviously that both candidates wanted. Marshawn may have been frustrated that he didn't get it. And it could help Kelly in this race, and we don't know where it stands right now in this race, you know, how close or not. Emily's List, Julie McLean, who is the communications director with Emily's List, she said in her statement that Steve Marchand is running so behind in this primary that he's resorting to sexist and ageist attacks. Well, I'm not sure. We haven't seen any public opinion polling yet. I think we're going to get some new stuff next week, hopefully from UNH and from St. A's. So hopefully we'll get a better picture of where that race stands.
In 2016, Colin Van Ostern got the endorsement, and Steve Marchand didn't get it that time around either, and so there was grumbling as well back then. It's an active political wing of Planned Parenthood. It can certainly provide resources and other kinds of help to Molly Kelly should she be the nominee. And so it's certainly something worth having within the context of Democratic primary politics.
Kelly's getting all the big endorsements in this race. No doubt about that. She's got all the
from
big,
the moment she got into the from race, the moment, literally.
Yeah, pretty much even before, let's be honest. She's got more money than Marchand as well. What we don't know is, you know, he seems to have a lot of grassroots support. What we don't know is where the race stands in the polling. And again, 4.5 weeks to go. The forums between the two candidates, though, Peter, have been getting a little feistier. No doubt about that. They face off again Monday night up at Dartmouth College.
Listeners, if you'd like to weigh in on this conversation, please call us 1-800-892-6477. You can also weigh in by email, exchange@nhpr.org. And let's talk to Tim in Portsmouth. Tim, thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. So I've been talking to Steve Marchand for over a year because he's been out on the campaign trail for over a year, which is why he might have a little more grassroots support. That's a good call. So when Molly Kelly went on to social media and invited questions and comments, I was quick to text her to see where she was at. And timid is a good description of her strategies, because I never really did get an answer when I asked her where she stood on a broad-based tax, which I think is an important issue for the future of New Hampshire. And I got a wishy-washy answer on the question about minimum wage, and a wishy-washy answer on the question about passenger rail, which is a pet thing of mine, which I think is also critical to the future of New Hampshire. So I can't help but think that Marchand's comment about her timidity is a good one, number one. And number two, I'm 66 years old, and Molly Kelly is too old to be the governor of New Hampshire. She can run just like Hillary Clinton could run, and Hillary Clinton got lots of support as soon as she entered the race, and it didn't work out that well. And I'm trying to say that I think Molly Kelly is the establishment candidate, and I don't think that is a good strategy for success.
Okay, so, Tim, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for calling. So, Paul,
I'm guessing that's a Marchand supporter. That's my guess. What do you think?
Yeah, it says so on my screen that he was a Marchand supporter.
Yeah, I will say, you know, it's a time-honored tradition in primary politics to avoid getting pinned down on issues for as long as humanly possible. That way you don't position yourself in the wrong spot for the general election. So, you know, some of this could be strategic. Some of it could just be how she prefers to present herself as a candidate. But, you know, clearly Tim is someone who's engaged in the process, and I'm sure there are people for supporting Molly Kelly who are out there as well. We're getting close. It's only a month away. And as we know, people start to focus on these because these primary races come right at the tail end of summer. People really start to tune in, you know, the last couple weeks. And so they're going to tap into this what has become a very kind of active, engaging race between the two.
And worth mentioning that people of any age have successfully held political office. That's just a fact. Just want to throw that out there. But listeners, definitely
exactly.
Weigh in if you have questions or comments about the week's news. 1-800-892-6477. I want to talk about the Democratic fundraising dinner, because it got a new name again this week. It's the dinner formerly known as the Jefferson Jackson Dinner. A couple of years ago, it was renamed the Kennedy Clinton Dinner. Now it's the Eleanor Roosevelt Dinner. State Democratic Party Chairman Ray Buckley says that the Eleanor Roosevelt Dinner is particularly fitting given our party's steadfast commitment to electing Democratic women. Paul, what's your take on this?
This was about a year in coming. Remember, it was changed from Jefferson Jackson by the state of New Hampshire and a few other states that called it the Jefferson Jackson dinner a couple of years back, back in 16, because Thomas Jefferson and Jackson were slave owners back in the late in the 18th and 19th centuries. So they went with Kennedy Clinton. But here now we had last year the rise of the Me Too movement. And of course, there are plenty of allegations out there against former President Bill Clinton when it comes to sexual harassment, even sexual assault. Last year at the dinner, hours before the dinner, the state party, the Republican state party chair, called on the Democrats to change the name of the dinner. That obviously didn't happen that day. But a few weeks later, at a major Democratic Party meeting, Peter, you saw a lot of activists call for the name, the name to be changed on the dinner. Now, months later, the Democratic Party finally taking action on this. They had a big vote about a week ago, and of the entire statewide committee, with a lot of progressives in that committee now, a lot of former Bernie Sanders supporters, and they voted to change the name, and the name that they went with was Eleanor Roosevelt, of course, the first lady of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and the first member, delegate from the United States to the United Nations.
UN delegate, yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting, I heard from this story actually got national coverage because there had been a number of states that changed their Jefferson Jackson dinners to other names, but New Hampshire apparently is the first one to have a second name change so quickly, and so it did get a little bit of coverage around the country. It's a kind of a interesting story to see, people have to kind of grapple with the unintended consequences of the choices they make or things that they hadn't completely thought through at the time.
And you make a good point there. I reported it here for local outlets here in New Hampshire, but I also reported that story for Fox News. As you can imagine, they were very interested.
Yeah,
what
saw
a surprise.
A number of
they
national
were very
outlets.
Surprised. National outlets that did this.
Cable
Here's
TV.
The thing about, though, this is the interesting thing. This is New Hampshire. This is the state that made Bill Clinton the comeback kid. Remember his surprise and strong second place finish in the 1992 primary here in New Hampshire had vaulted him into a battle that he eventually won the Democratic nomination and then the White House. New Hampshire is almost like hallowed ground for the Clintons. So for this to happen, it's got to sting a little bit. And it also shows the New Hampshire Democratic Party and where it is in 2018. This was a party that very much a couple years ago was in the Bill and Hillary Clinton wing. That is not the same anymore. I tell you, Bernie Sanders' big victory in the 2016 primary here over Hillary Clinton has changed the New Hampshire Democratic Party to a degree. This couldn't have happened a few years ago. It happened this week.
And at the 2017 then Kennedy Clinton dinner, Casey McDermott reported the name of the dinner was a topic of discussion then. Here's one of the state party vice chairs, Mo Baxley.
I'm pushing for the Eleanor Roosevelt dinner. Tired of all the boys.
And so she got it.
I spoke to Mo about a minute or two after Casey did it last year when that dinner was held in Hollis. It took a while. It took a while, but they had their vote, and now the name has changed. And the Democratic Party here in the state moves on, right?
Yes, a lot has changed in 26 years, certainly, since Clinton first became the comeback kid. And now things have moved on for the Democrats, it seems. But let's talk about another thing facing the Democratic Party right now. Last week, we reported on Senator Jeff Woodburn, the Democrat who was arrested on charges of domestic violence. He is still on the ballot. And as we talked about last week on this program, unless he moves out of the district, he'll remain on that ballot. And on the Republican side is a man by the name of David Starr. Dean, who's David Starr?
And in fact, so far, my understanding is that it's Senator Woodburn's intention to stay on the ballot. I think he's planning on running for re-election, but we'll see how the whole situation plays out. Yeah, David Starr for the Republicans, he's new to politics. He's never run for office before. He's 75. He's retired Air Force. He's an engineer. He's kind of getting things together gradually, learning the ropes a little bit. He has a Facebook page up now. Interestingly enough, at one point earlier in the year, Jeff Woodburn, I think, was feeling pretty invincible and offered to pay the filing fee for any Republican that would stand for election against him, in jest. And now it's interesting to see the way things have turned around. We'll see what happens. This isn't a guaranteed Democratic seat. It can kind of go back and forth. A lot of it will depend on how voters in the North Country react to the Woodburn situation. But David Starr says he's willing to give it a try. He defines himself as a fairly mainstream conservative Republican. You know, low taxes, control spending, supports right to work. Believes he would fit in pretty well with the Republican caucus here in Concord.
And so, Paul, what's your best guess on what that campaign's going to be like now?
This is a seat that was going to be pretty safe for the Democrats. Not anymore, obviously. Remember, here's the dynamic in the battle for the state Senate. 14 Republicans, 10 Democrats. The Democrats are trying to retake the majority. This is obviously a setback for them. I spoke to Donna Soucy this week. Donna Soucy was the number two Democrat in the chamber. She's the state senator from Manchester. And I asked her, are you guys going to put up a writing candidate on the primary to try to, you know, defeat Woodburn, because Woodburn, again, hasn't said whether he's resigning or not. She wouldn't say whether the Democrats would or wouldn't, but twice when I asked her, she pointed back to her statement from her and the other Democrats in the chamber that Woodburn needs to resign. So this is a bizarre situation, and as the Democrats try to win back the chamber, this could be a big impediment.
And she had been the deputy leader of the Democrats. Yeah. She's now the interim. The Democratic caucus in the Senate voted to make her the interim minority leader, and you know, we'll see whether she decides to run for that job permanently. My assumption is she would, but I don't know.
I asked her, and she wouldn't say. She just said, listen, we got enough to worry about between now and November.
I'm guessing it's probable, but we'll see.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We've got a lot of political news to discuss this week. And still to come, a Republican candidate in the race for New Hampshire's 2nd District, Lynn Blankenbecker, will join us to answer your questions and spell out her policy positions. So now's the time to get your question ready. You can send it by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call now. We'll put you in the queue for when we have Lynn in the studio. The number is 1-800-892-6477. I'll say the number again a little slower. 1-800-892-6477. Sometimes people like to write it down, so you get to slow it down a little
old
bit.
Old school. They go old school.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Well, Paul, I wanted to ask you one more political question about the first congressional district forum that happened in Laconia last night. How did that go?
This was interesting. A lot of policy, as it should be. 10 of the 11 Democrats running. There are 11 Democrats running in the first district to try to succeed Carol Shea Porter. But normally you don't see a candidate go after the moderator. Often candidates squabble with each other, and we saw plenty of that last night. But one of the candidates, Levy Sanders, of course, the son of Bernie Sanders, got into a little, some sparks were flying between him and State Party Chairman Ray Buckley, who was the moderator of the forum because it was organized and put together by the State Party. Sanders has been vocally complaining that there haven't been any debates yet, just these forums. Him and Buckley got into it. And Sanders was also booed when he started criticizing both Buckley and some of the other candidates in the race. He was booed by and heckled by a few people in the crowd. So it was a bizarre moment. If you want to learn more about it, go to the Concord Monitor. Check out my story.
Well, there's also, as we've talked about before on this program, a strain of thought in the Democratic Party that Democrats need to be nice to each other. And it doesn't seem like Levy Sanders was attempting to be nice.
Well, listen, everybody in this race, there's 11 candidates. Everybody's trying to grab some attention, right? Everybody's trying to stand out. Sanders has been very vocal in his support of Medicaid for All, the single-payer plan. He's been critical of Chris Pappas and Maura Sullivan, two of the perceived leaders in the race. And he's also been critical of the party, and those criticisms continued yesterday. If he wanted media attention, he got a little bit of it.
Yeah, and these issues, you know, we deal with this with the presidential election as well. When you have a huge multi-candidate field, everybody's kind of throwing elbows, trying to get noticed, you know, get these slivers of 30 seconds to a minute or maybe 2 minutes at a time to state your case. You know, we've talked before about Levy Sanders' candidacy. He lives over on the Vermont border in the Claremont area, but he's running in the first CD. On the other side of the state, the whole candidacy has been sort of a little perplexing at times, and we don't really have a good sense of the extent to which he's tapping into his father's progressive networks. His father has kind of been hands-off, said he's got to make or break this race on his own, Levy Sanders, that is. It's going to be a fascinating primary. I'm looking forward to seeing what happens on the 11th of September.
And talking about his father, guess what? His father is, I'll tout this, as I first reported earlier this week, his father's coming back. He'll be headlining the big AFL-CIO breakfast on Labor Day. Guess what? Fifth straight year he's done that. It may be a little awkward if Levy's there because, again, Dean just said, he has not endorsed his son. But it also, with Bernie Sanders coming back to New Hampshire for the first time in almost a year, it's sparking more speculation about Bernie Sanders maybe making another run for the Democratic nomination in 2020.
All right. Well, that's Paul Steinhauser, political reporter. We've also got Dean Spiliotis here in the studio from SNHU. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us for this part of the program. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. And coming up, Lynn Blankenbecker joins us to talk about what she would do if she were elected to Congress from New Hampshire's 2nd District. If you've got questions, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. This is The Exchange.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.